This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. Next, we turn to our guest, Ashley Mears, an associate professor of sociology from Boston University. Ashley is the author of Pricing Beauty, The Making of a Fashion Model from the University of California Press, and she has a new project that I'm sure we'll get the chance to talk about. She also currently serves as chair of the ASA section on consumers and consumption. Thank you very much for joining us, Ashley. Can we start off? So tell us, what's news with the ASA section on consumers and consumption?
Oh, it's big news. We just reached a threshold of 300 members, which means that we get one extra session for the ASA meetings in Philadelphia. But like we actually have just 300 members. Like we just made it. So a lot of my colleagues are now members of the section and graduate students. And what we'll do with that extra session is a special theme on new approaches to inequality and consumption. And so we're hoping that this will draw some interest for the meetings coming in Philadelphia.
Awesome. And tell us about Boston University sociology. What's it like? What's its thing?
Okay. This is kind of interesting. So it used to be a real micro place. They actually had an ethnomethodology center here. People like George Saffis were really active. And actually, when I gave my job talk 8 years ago, the back of the room had blinds over mirrors that actually were two-way mirrors, because in the adjoining office, this is where they would do their observations, you know, for like interactional studies. We have since walled that up, unfortunately, so we no longer have this the structural legacy. But we still have quite a lot of qualitative people. I think that my colleagues are, a lot of us are doing culture theory. We have a cluster in economic sociology. It's a place where you would come if you wanted to study ethnography and culture in the urban and markets. And yeah, I think that's kind of what we're known for now.
And can you tell us about the project you're working on now?
Yeah, so I'm finishing a book that's based on ethnography that I conducted in VIP nightclubs. So VIP meaning very important people. And these are nightclubs that offer bottle service. I studied them in New York and the summer colony of the Hamptons, Saint-Tropez, and in Miami. So I followed what's kind of colloquially known as this jet set calendar of economic elites who go to these upscale luxury destinations and go to nightclubs and spend a ton of money. So the bottle prices are like markup of anywhere like 500 to 1,000%. You could find bottles, like a single bottle for like $5,000 of Cristal champagne. And so the bottles are carried to a patron, or they're called clients. They rent a table for the night in these clubs, and the bottles are carried to their table with fireworks attached to them. So it's a clear case to think about Veblen and conspicuous consumption. And so the book is all about the staging of conspicuous consumption, all of the backstage labor that it takes to pull off ostentation, which, you know, from a Bourdieusian point of view, we would think that, you know, it's kind of gross and bad behavior to be so strategic and showing off with your wealth to try to get status from your wealth. And yet, you know, these clubs and many other kinds of formats offer spaces for people to showcase their wealth and their money.
Yeah, I got to say, I'm a huge fan of this project and have been ever since I saw you give a talk on it, like, I don't know, 3 years ago. And in fact, when Joe and I were doing a practice episode of the podcast, I basically was just talking about your project the whole time, which I refer to, but I understand if you wouldn't prefer to call it this. I call it the douchebag potlatch. I just, you know, see it as
thanks.
Like, so yeah, I wouldn't pick you to call your book that or something. Although if you want that title, you can have it. You know, it's just like such a great illustration of so many things. You have the conspicuous consumption, you know, the mobilization of temporary clients. You have this incredibly complicated way that the models are brought to the tables that's, you know, somewhat market-based and somewhat gift-based. And it's just endlessly fascinating.
Sorry, go ahead.
What's the gift aspect of this? Like, I understand the transactional element. I don't even understand what's the practical ends being sought by paying so much for bottle service.
Right.
Can you explain this to me?
Right. Like, if you had $10,000, you probably wouldn't like spend it on a bunch of champagne that you wouldn't even drink because it's too much liquid to realistically consume. But yeah, so on the one hand, this is a pool of people who have a lot of disposable income. They're working in industries like finance, where money is easy come. And we know from the sociology of money that the way you make your money influences how you spend your money. So it's easy come, easy go. So yeah, they kind of, the sums are maybe the equivalent of you getting a Starbucks coffee, let's say. Right. So for the one, this is like a pool of super rich people. And that term has actually been used by economists to describe this pool of people who are earning just so much money at the top 1% or 0.01% even. And so on the other hand, what they're purchasing is this temporary platform to show their money and to have this VIP luxury experience that actually is incredibly fun and seductive for everybody who's there, not just the clients who are spending, but also the young women who are mobilized to come into the club to be a part of the audience to bear witness to these huge sums that are spent. And those women are often models or they're called just girls. And so when I was doing the field work, I went into the field as a girl, and I was like 32 at the time, but I was just, you know, accepted, like 32-year-olds are girls in this space if they are women. So there's two aspects of the gift. Gabriel mentioned the potlatch. So the potlatch is this form of like a magnificent gift that a ruler or, you know, tribal chieftain gives out to people in some ritualized event, knowing full well that it can't be repaid. So the logic of the gift from Marcel Mauss is that if somebody gives you something, you know, it's not free, that it always builds expectations of reciprocity and obligation. And if you can't pay it back, that's a mark of shame or dishonor. That's like, that's where that's why charity feels bad to people who are on the receiving end. So yeah, the like gift is mobilized on the one hand, because it's, sometimes people will buy huge bottles of champagne and they'll waste it, they'll shake it and spray it, or they'll just gift bottles. You know, it's not uncommon in Saint-Tropez during peak party season to walk out of the club carrying a $2,000 bottle of Dom Perignon champagne. And so that's the gift. It gives status to the giver. And then there's also this whole elaborate economy of gifting that happens between the people who are organizing the nightclub and the girls who they bring into the club. So the girls are there and they're not getting paid to be there, even though their presence is generating, you know, this kind of potlatch dynamics of huge sums of money. But rather the girls are receiving free access or free drinks and free dinners. And so they're also being gifted things, you know, compliments of the house, they're getting comped. In addition to these kind of elaborate relationships that get constructed between the club organizers, these are men who are called promoters, and the girls, including friendship, they have all these shared time together, they hang out together, they have sex together. You know, they have like all of these intimate relations that help mobilize the girls to come to a club and work for free. So yeah, multiple layers there.
Yeah, so in these spaces, you also have the bottle girls who are being paid, right?
Right.
And so, you know, how are they different from the bottle girls who are just there to, you know, sort of hang out and be comped?
Right. Yeah. So you have lots of different types of women in the space. The bottle girls are kind of, I think maybe people are familiar with them from the famous case of Rachel Utetel, who was a bottle girl from Vegas and then in New York. And she was waiting on Tiger Woods. So when the Tiger Woods story broke, Rachel Utetel was in the news and people were interested in this job. And so the bottle girls, often they're hired by the club to be cocktail waitresses, but their job is actually more complicated. They also get retained by the club if they are also bringing in clients. So part of a bottle girl's job is like that of a promoter, of bringing in the right kind of clientele that the club wants. So they're also expected to form relations with clients and to mobilize the big spenders to come out to a club as well. There's a big symbolic difference between bottle girls and the girls at a promoter's table. The girls at the promoter's table, I mean, these are often called the image the image tables. They have a certain kind of image of fashion models. So they're very tall, they're very thin. They have the air of exclusivity and high status that fashion connotes. The bottle girls tend to be more curvaceous, more like heteronormatively sexually available. Their uniforms are often low cut, you know, revealing kinds of dresses. They're in a sense marked more as the sex, whereas the girls at the promoter table are marked as the beauty. And there's a kind of classic distinction between the sex and the beauty when we talk about the value of women. There's a third category of women that are in the space, and these are called table girls. So some of the clubs will hire girls who might be out of work fashion models or you know, some kind of girl in between a bottle girl and in between looking like a bottle girl and a model. And the table girls will be just standing at the bar, and they're paid like $100 a night by the club.
Not very much.
But then they'll go and sit with a client. If a client wants, you know, women company and you know, doesn't have its own models, we'll get a table girl. And the table girls are also kind of discursively marked as being more sexually available. They're talked about as sluts or, you know, doing a dirty job. The bottle girls are also seen as doing a dirty job. So I think that there's something really important about the money, the fact that some women in this space are clearly monetizing their sexual capital or beauty capital in the club, and they're on a kind of lower end side of a boundary that distinguishes the model, who is also there, you know, lending her sexual capital or beauty capital into the club, but she doesn't get paid. And not getting paid makes her higher status.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me about that is that the models will get paid in other contexts, right? I mean, their mm-hmm. job is to be models, so their job is to, you know, be somewhere, be pretty, and be seen being pretty. Mm-hmm. You know, very, you know, usually with the picture being taken, but still fundamentally it's about being someone and being pretty, and they get paid cash, right? If you do a catalog, if somebody does a catalog shoot or an editorial shoot or whatever, they'll get paid cash for that. But if somebody, but these same people would not necessarily get paid for appearing at a table. Instead, they get paid in the form of they have this patron-client relationship with the promoter who takes them and all their friends miniature golfing or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's not that they don't, you know, get paid for being pretty ever. It's just right. In this specific context, they are there because they have a gift relationship, and that changes the value. And ironically, they're worth giving the gifts to because they get paid for being pretty in another context.
Right, right, yeah. And they have the status of having been chosen by the fashion industry for being pretty enough, you know, unlike the bottle girl, for instance.
What do they think? They networking or – like I'm having trouble getting my head around the right. motivations here.
Okay. So first, you know, to similar to your earlier question about why would somebody spend money like this in a club? Like, it is really, really fun if you could put yourself in the mindset of an 18-year-old to have access to nightclubs and, you know, Cannes in Miami and New York, all for free. You know, drinking the best champagne amid the most celebrated kind of places in the city, and then to be able to relay it on social media to say that you were there, and you know, you got into this exclusive space, which by definition means everybody else got excluded. So you're of high value enough. I think that's incredibly seductive in its own right for the girls who are there. Some of them are strategically oriented. They talked in interviews. Some of them think that they can meet people who will be useful for their careers. They have aspirations in fashion. Some of them have aspirations in even finance. I mean, it's a big range of girls and what they're hoping to do in the future. But most of them are pretty aware that they are just here for the fun of the night.
Well, what I find really interesting is that I kind of feel like you're looking at it from like, from the very top, from the elite. But if I think about club culture, I actually see that as trickling down throughout. And in many ways, so much of what makes club owners and the club industry be able to make money is this, okay, this gifting of access to young women, right? Mm-hmm. To come into the club, right? Sometimes because they're like, you're going to dance and we need entertainment. Or you're going to dance and you're also really pretty. And mm-hmm. the men are the ones who are going to be spending most of the money anyway. Mm-hmm. And so we let you in for free and we don't card you even. Mm-hmm. But we'll card all of the men, right? And they will come in and you will be part of our money making machine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the logic of ladies' night. Yeah. Yeah. Everywhere. Yeah.
Well, what are we learning, though, about sort of gender relations or power? Like, what when after going through this, what do we learn?
Okay, well, for me, I think it's a case of contemporary traffic in women. I mean, traffic in the old anthropological sense of the word, where women are used as conduits of exchange to build relationships between men. And so someone like Gail Rubin, she's, you know, thinking about how women historically have been passed through, say, tribal systems in order to build alliances between different tribal leaders. And so women don't accrue any of the benefits. They enable a lot of the benefits through their own circulation that men control, and those benefits go to men. And so, yeah, this is, like, on the one hand, it's a very old kind of concept to explain gender inequality. But on the other hand, like, when you start thinking about it, like this kind of system of traffic in women, it starts to explain the VIP party scene, because it's women who are brought in to a place. They get very few benefits, and men are reaping all of these benefits. It's like men who are controlling the club industry. It's almost entirely men who are promoters. Wealthy clients meet and entertain and do business with one another through these channels. In part, they forge bonds through flirting with young women, and women are kind of largely cut out of this whole system of profit that they're enabling. And so, yeah, it's an example of a contemporary system of traffic in women. I think that it has similar dynamics that you could look at with, for instance, the fraternity scene, which I mentioned earlier. You know, I see it on my own campus and throughout Greek colleges. Like, the best fraternity house has the best parties, defined by who has the best looking girls on campus, you know, and like those benefits don't go to the girls who are actually put in positions of risk and danger to be plied with alcohol at fraternity parties. So, I mean, it's a way of thinking structurally about this reproduction of systems of inequality. I think that it also, at least from the kind of subjective point of view of the girls, it helps me think about why women consent to systems of their own exploitation. And I think that we've been wrong in thinking that exploitation and empowerment are at completely opposite theoretical ends. I actually think that there is something incredibly empowering and seductive in the moment for a girl who is in this position of exploiting herself at a nightclub, that being a sexual object and being the object of a gaze is itself a reward. I mean, I found this with my first book, In Pricing Beauty, too, but I didn't go in this direction as much. But I've been trying to think about this, like, yeah, these the seductions of exploitation.
So I have a question. So I know I've seen women come in and get, you know, and get these tables, and do they not request the same kind of bottle service? So how are women different?
Right. Yeah. So at the places that I was studying, it was almost always men, which is really surprising because we know that they're also very rich women. I mean, not as many and not on as big a scale. But they were seen as a not. So occasionally it happens that women will be clients and they'll come in and they'll buy bottles, and they're always talked about as anomalies, as being, you know, these kind of weird cases of like weird women. Because the whole space is this very like heteronormative space that's geared towards like a heterosexual male gaze and heterosexual male ways of interacting with women. So I think it's you know, I published a paper a while ago, or like a little op-ed, and I got a couple of emails of women who were like, what about us? Because we also party. But they weren't going into the exact same spaces, but they also had a circuit of nightclubs where they went to show off, and they were like, you know, high-end, successful professional women. So yeah, I mean, I my sense is that it's just a different niche of nightclubbing, in which there's lots of different niches of clubs that cater to all kinds of different tastes. And the reason I was drawn to this one was I was interested in these dynamics of conspicuous consumption among the very top of the economic elite.
Does it really get them anything? Like, are you going to get a Goldman Sachs presidency by vice presidency?
No.
So, and then the question is, so who's really, like, where is the exploitation going? I mean, if you're, it seems like the promoter is just exploiting everybody with the, what seems to me, maybe I'm, well, I know I'm certainly naive on this whole scene, but it seems like just a bunch of empty transactions that the proprietor, the business proprietor, is ultimately enjoying the fruits of.
Yes. So that, I think that that's right. Like the fruits of all of this go ultimately to the owners, many of whom are themselves former promoters. So there's a kind of career ladder for promoters to open their own nightclubs. Like you don't get you might get some benefits at Goldman, certainly not like JP Morgan, for instance, you know, like different banks have different profiles. Indeed, for people in different sectors, even in some sectors of finance, I think like oil and commodities and private equity, I think that these are spaces in which certain types of men can bond, not all types of men for sure. But I think ultimately the club industry just is really good at creating profits for their owners.
Did you say that it was also kind of a life course thing for men, that like rich guys in their 20s or early 30s might do this, but for the most part, they age out?
Right. Yeah. So it wouldn't be unheard of to see like a 60-year-old man, you know, buying bottles. But it's less common than you would see among like men who have a lot of money in their 20s and 30s. At a certain point, you know, one's home life stabilizes, or you know, one's career becomes both very demanding, but also you know, higher stakes, and so you can't squander money in public in the same way that you would when you were younger. It's the wrong image. You can see this also with the Tumblr website, Rich Kids of Instagram, RKOI. It's like Rich Kids. If you take a look at it, it's a really interesting website that curates the Instagram pictures of young economic elites who are engaged in wasteful behavior. I mean, things that are really common to what I would find in the nightclubs, like, spraying champagne at each other, having really huge bottles of champagne that you can't even carry, pouring champagne in the bathtub, giving it to your dog. There's like lots of creative ways of wasting champagne. Like the most cliched one is the champagne bath. You know, that's overdone. But there, I mean, it's called Rich Kids of Instagram for a reason. I mean, these are mostly young people who are, who don't have the high stakes just yet for their own reputations or for their, you know, businesses' reputations. And so they're engaged in these kinds of rituals of waste.
Yeah, I just looked it up and I see somebody getting on a private jet and then a young woman in her early 20s trying to chug a 10-liter bottle of champagne.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny.
It sounds exhausting.
Yeah, a lot of the behavior that you describe to me is really, you know, aside from it, you know, being, you know, sort of like this corollary to the potlatch, kind of seems to me more like sort of braggadocio that comes with being young and having too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've been working on a theory paper about the irony of conspicuous consumption, about like this kind of behavior is ostentation as ironic, which, mm-hmm. I mean, Veblen himself was making this kind of scathing, ironic critique of the mm-hmm. economic elite in the early 1900s. But he was actually being kind of serious, you know, in his like hostile critique of the rich.
Oh, for sure.
But
he never
really took into the possibility that the rich themselves were being ironic in the way that they were wasting. I mean, for him, they're being very strategic and they're wanting status, and that's why they're having this like one-upmanship in what they spend and how they show it. But certainly in the nightclub and in sites like Rich Kids of Instagram, I think a lot of it is this sort of ironic performance where people know that this looks bad. People know that there's a critique of wasteful behavior, and yet they engage in this anyway. And they appropriate that critique sometimes, even in the way, for instance, some of the bottle buyers would say, like, I know this looks gross and there's starving children in Africa, but I'm going to do it anyway. And they would proceed to then take pictures of, you know, their hundreds of bottles of champagne.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's almost as though, but is it them being ironic, or is it them being like, actually, I'm above your critique?
Or like a humble brag, right? Where you're like, I want to show up, yeah. But I don't want you to think I'm showing up.
Right. No, the way that I conceive of irony here is in these terms of when somebody knows that this is bad behavior and they go for it anyway, which creates this like next layer of domination, right? It's like someone who is savvy enough to know highbrow from lowbrow, or to understand these distinctions, and who crosses those boundaries anyway, and plays with the fact that they know that they cross those boundaries.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.